In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's a handful for him. There's a great finish. We did mention him, Charlie Davies. He got the goal which beat Serbia. He's got the goal this evening which puts the USA in front in this final.
Charlie Davies, he's 19 years of age and he's from Boston, and he said he'd love a club in the Premiership.
There's the hero. There's the man who got the hat-trick. Charlie Davies. Remember that name. We might hear it again.
Genombrottet i landslaget hade kommit. VM-platsen var redan säkrad. Klivet till en större liga var genomfört efter succén i Hammarby, där han stod för många mål och blev en favorit bland supportrarna. Allt pekade uppåt för Charlie Davies, fram till en ödesdiger utekväll som slutade med en bilolycka där en ung kvinna dog och kvinnan som körde bilen dömdes till fängelse. Och för anfallaren väntade en lång rehabtid eftersom han blev svårt skadad. Och han blev sig aldrig lik på planen igen. I podden berättar Davies om den där kvällen där ett felbeslut förändrade allt. Och detta bara några månader innan anfallaren skulle få chansen att uppfylla sin livslånga dröm att få spela i VM.
I still had to relearn how to walk, how to take a shower, how to put on clothes, how to eat food.
Vi pratar naturligtvis om tiden i Hammarby och i Allsvenskan och att Davies efter 12 år nu erkänner att armbågen på Micke Almebäck i Örebro faktiskt var med meningen.
And so I threw my elbow back to catch him. Caught him in the mouth, I believe, or the nose, I can't remember. And thought, okay, well, this was off the ball. You know, I'll say I was trying to defend, the ball. And so yeah, I thought I got away with it.
Vi diskuterar även fotbollens tillväxt i USA och statusen på MLS, ligan som Charlie Davies framförallt spelade i efter att han mirakulöst nog återkommit till fotbollen.
I was never the same player because I lost, you know, two or three steps of speed. So I was still kind of fast, but not the quickness I had in the past. But I was so proud of myself to know that I got back to be able to play.
Men podden är naturligtvis mer än det här. Vi pratar om Davies nuvarande karriär i mediebranschen, om att han tror att Zlatan blivit kvar i MLS om han spelat för en annan klubb än LA Galaxy. Om skräcken kring Davies cancerbesked, vilken kontakt han har med Hammarby idag och varför han fastnade för fotboll i ett land där sporten egentligen inte är särskilt stor. Samt att han längtar efter den dagen då han får ta med sig sina barn på en Hammarby-match i Stockholm. Men som vanligt börjar vi podden med en faktaruta. Age?
I am 35 years old.
Where do you live?
I live in Boston, Massachusetts.
Family?
I have a wife and twin boys. They're 5 years old.
Education?
I went to Boston College.
Salary?
I have a lot of different occupations, so I have a good salary.
What do you drive?
I drive an Audi Q7.
What do you read?
I read a number of things. I read a lot of nonprofit mission statements.
What do you watch?
I watch whatever my wife wants to watch.
What do you listen to?
I listen to music that inspires me or gets me to dance. So I have an eclectic mix.
What do you play?
What do I play? I play sports with my kids.
Which is your greatest experience as a soccer player?
Well, as you know, my career has had many ups and downs. But if I had to pick one, my greatest moment was scoring in Azteca Stadium for the U.S. men's national team.
What's the best trophy that you won or some honor that you picked during your career?
Man. Usually, I guess playing for the Olympic team, the U.S. Olympics team.
The toughest opponent that you met?
Spain in the 2009 Confederations Cup.
Do you have a jersey that you're really happy that you switch with some other player?
I do. And it's a tie between Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Thierry Henry.
Which rule would you like to change in soccer?
Which rule? A more consistent VAR usage.
Which team is your favorite team and why?
Arsenal is my favorite club, and that would be because Thierry Henry and Patrick Vieira and that era of the Gunners was all I could watch at the time. And so naturally, that's why I supported them.
Favorite movie?
Favorite movie. I love movies, and this is probably the hardest one. But if I was going to go all the way back and one that stands out to me because it was a family movie, it would be Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
As a former professional, you probably bought a lot of stuff. Which is your worst buy?
It would probably be, oh man. Yeah, there's been a lot of bad buys. My first year with Hammarby, the captain, Mikael Jensen, took me shopping and because my style was so bad. So he took me to the Galerian in Studioplan. And I remember I purchased a pair of pants that just didn't fit me and it wasn't great. So, and they were super expensive. So that would be one of the worst purchases that I've made.
When do you lie?
When do I lie? I feel like sometimes I'm too nice, so I can't tell people the truth sometimes.
If we take away sports, what was your best subject in school?
History.
When was the last time you were really, really happy?
Yesterday, putting up Christmas decorations with the kids.
We ran into each other at Anfield, I guess that's your connection with football today. What do you do exactly?
I do a lot of different things, which I think keeps it fun and keeps me engaged post-playing career. So I'm the broadcast analyst for the New England Revolution here. I am the in-studio analyst for CBS, which is why you saw me. For the U.S. men's national team, but they also had me do sideline reporting for Champions League, which was my first time there. I am the analyst for all of Major League Soccer's digital content. I'm on the radio for Sirius XM. And then I run a nonprofit in the city of Boston that kind of uplifts many different people across different spectrums who are struggling or suffering or need support.
You have a lot to do. How is it to still be in contact with the sport that you kind of fell in love with when you were a kid?
Yes, I knew I could never just walk away from the sport that I've grown up that has given me so many opportunities. So I think when I retired, I knew I wanted to be involved, but I knew I didn't want to coach, at least to start. I wanted something where I felt like I could make a bigger impact. Not to say that coaching isn't down the line in the future, that I couldn't make a tremendous impact, but I felt that TV is a way that I could still grow the sport, keep people interested, and still stay connected. And then I worked in the front office for the New England Revolution because I wanted to learn the business of the sport. And so those two, I think, are a great way for me to still stay involved. And, you know, if a sporting director is in my future or a club president, I want to keep all those options and those doors open.
How come you fell in love with soccer, since in the US it is still quite a small sport?
Yes, it was by accident. I had never seen the sport before, and I brought home a piece of paper from school. It was a permission slip, and I was hoping that, you know, it was to play American football. And my father, who's from Gambia, got really excited and said, "This is what you want to do?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely." And so he took me to the store, and the next thing I know, I'm getting soccer cleats and a ball and shin guards. And I thought, oh man, I made the wrong mistake. But I couldn't tell my father that I think that we have a mistake on our hands. And so he brought me to the tryout. I didn't make the team. I could tell he was disappointed. I was disappointed because you don't want to be, not good in any particular thing. So he asked me, is this something you want to be good at? And I said, yes. And so from that day, all we did was train. And I really didn't love the sport until I went to a World Cup match. And I went to a World Cup match 2 years later. So I was 8 years old. And I got to see for my birthday, Bolivia versus South Korea. Two boring teams. It was a boring game, but I think the spectacle of being at a World Cup and seeing so many different walks of life and so many people and just the passion and the intensity, I said, yes, this is what I want to do. And I kind of think that that's when the dream was born for me.
And that was the World Cup in the US 94?
Yes.
And your father, who's from Gambia, Kofi, he was a former soccer player too.
Yes.
But he didn't try to push you in that direction. It was you who selected the wrong sport.
Yes. I mean, he definitely pushed me once I wanted to do it, but he never pushed me in the beginning to learn about the sport, to kind of show me the sport. It really happened as an accident. And then it was, okay, we're going to make this your future.
When did you understand that you were quite good and that you maybe had a future in living of playing football?
I would say when I was 16, I traveled to Europe with the regional team of the United States, the Eastern Regional Team. And we played in the Blue Dens Cup in Austria. And I scored a bicycle kick against the Austrian national team. I scored against Stuttgart. And I had a phenomenal tournament, and I thought, okay, I have a future in the sport, and not only playing in the US, but I think playing in Europe. And then when I played in the Milk Cup and we won the tournament, I knew for sure that that's my dream, and I can be quite good.
How is soccer doing in the US today?
I think it just keeps getting bigger and bigger each year. The 2018 World Cup, not qualifying for that. Yes, it was painful, but I think it drew a lot of eyes to the sport. And a lot of people who maybe weren't that interested in soccer all of a sudden were like, why aren't we playing in the World Cup? What happened? And so I think people were generally interested in the sport and how can we get back to competing and playing in the World Cups? And we just have such a phenomenal generation right now who are all playing in Europe, who are all pretty successful on their clubs, and they're very young. So now I think we're heading in the right direction. There's hope. There's new hope around the program. And so I think with the women's national team, who are always dominant, who are quite successful, and now this, this young men's national team who are playing for their clubs on Champions League, in the Champions League, and as well as for the U.S. men's national team finally having success, now there's a real buzz around the sport, especially considering the World Cup is here in 2026.
And it's an old Hammarby coach who's the men's national team coach, Greg Berhalter, who was here in Hammarby.
Yes, we had a pleasant conversation about Hammarby when I got to play, actually when he moved back here and was coaching for the Columbus Crew. We played against them, and we had a catch up just on Stockholm, and he said, man, those fans love you. They still love you. And what a place, you know, it was for him to coach and understand how kind of football works in Europe. And, you know, you probably can't start at a better club, with Hammarby and the support. So, we talked, quite in depth about that. And then Tony Gustafsson also coached for the U.S. women's national team. So there's a lot of, you know, people who are connected to Hammarby, in the United States.
In Sweden and in many Nordic countries, maybe some other countries also in Europe, there's quite a big discussion about going to Qatar with all their problems with migrant workers and that homosexuality is illegal and so on. What discussion is there in the U.S. about that?
There's a lot of discussions around the World Cup and the things that are happening in Qatar and how I think our country is really, you know, pushing, you know, full inclusivity and diversity and being accepting of one another. And so I'm interested to see how it plays out, because this is a sport that I think is on the forefront of changing culture around the world, especially in sports. If we can continue to bring awareness to it and then we have a successful World Cup, I think it's going to change the game for everyone to be comfortable, to be who they want to be and not have to hide. So I think, yeah, the discussions around the World Cup are, one, it's, you know, I think it starts with the corruption of why they are hosting the World Cup to begin with, but we move past that because you can't change anything now. And now it's just about making sure that this is the right World Cup, that we continue to progress with humanity and making sure that rights of everyone are being honored. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, it's hard to really talk on it when we're here and I'm not on the front lines and I can't see what's happening in Qatar, but we all are well aware of Qatar and their stance on homosexuality.
In Sweden, we've also followed kind of the battle between the women's national team and the federation about the equal pay. What's your, where are you in that battle?
I've always been a supporter of the women. You know, Mia Hamm was one of my role models as a kid. So, and I get the chance to work with some of the incredible alums of that program. So yes, they deserve what the men are getting, just because that's, I think right now in our country, we're also fighting for equal rights for women and we're still not there yet. So we have a long way to go in every facet, I think, of the country in terms of equality and equity. And so I think for the women, they've continue to drive this sport as well and make it popular and draw more eyes to it and attention to it. So I couldn't be more proud of what they've been able to accomplish on the pitch. I know it's getting harder because the rest of the world are starting to catch up and putting more resources into their programs, but they're still the top dogs. They're still the stars. And I know the men's national team as well are in full support of the women and the women's league as well in the U.S.
On his now, puts it across into the net. Charlie Davies is back. He gives it to Davies. There's number two. It's into the net. On slotting it for Davies. That's number three. It's in the net. It's in the net. Charlie Davies. Boy, is he back.
Marl throwing his body in. It's going to fall for Ibrahimovic. Oh, come on! Come on! Amazing. A world-class goal from a world-class player.
I know that the Premier League had a record money now when NBC signed a new six-year deal. So soccer is growing in the U.S. How is the MLS doing?
The MLS is fantastic. I mean, it's growing. I think they finally understand what success is and who this league is, the identity of this league. If you want to be amongst the top leagues, then you have to, one, make sure that everyone in the league is moving in the same direction. I think now you look at the Major League Soccer model, there's a lot of clubs in Europe and leagues in Europe that are like, we need that because we're never in doubt of clubs when it comes to debt. You know, we're always moving forward. And I think we've also identified a way to groom players here and sell them to the top clubs in Europe. So now players in South America, when, you know, a lot of them are highly talented and are destined for it, they can still come to Major League Soccer, have a good life, be supported, still develop, and then potentially still make it to Europe if that's their dream, or they're very happy and content with being a star in Major League Soccer and trying to win trophies. So yeah, I think the league has done a terrific job of growing. Now players are getting paid properly and still have some ways to go. But it's a league that has, I think, really attracted the top young talent now. You're not just looking for the old retirement players, which is one way to describe it back in the day. I think now it's not that.
One player many thought maybe was retiring when he moved to LA Galaxy. He's now back in Milan scoring gold. What was your view of Zlatan Ibrahimovic and the impact he had during two seasons for the Galaxy?
He is an incredible, incredible player. And I love the fact as well that he left and is part owner of Hammarby, which pumped me up. But yeah, he came here and he performed. I think he had to showcase to the world that he still got it at his age, which he does. And I think we're well aware of how good Zlatan is at every step of the way. Even in Milan and in Serie A, he's still scoring goals when he's healthy, when he's on the field. He's that good. He's gifted. He's almost a, you know, once in a lifetime kind of player. So I think when he came to the United States, it was new. It took him zero time to adjust because he's that good, but he's constantly looking for challenges. And so he came, he felt like he got a good understanding and a philosophy of how MLS is. There's some good things. There's some things that need to be improved. I think it didn't help that his team wasn't, I think, the most situated team. It was a team that was kind of still trying to figure out who they are in a rebuild. If he was in another club, he probably would have maybe stayed in Major League Soccer. But yeah, he came. He brought a lot of attention to the league. He's masterful at I think stirring up things at the right time. He's great at what he does. He's an entertainer, and he's still got it. He's talented. I would have loved to have played with him. That's for sure. But yeah, I think everyone in Major League Soccer is very happy that he decided to come for a couple of years.
He started out with a big ad, "You're welcome, LA." And how was his attitude appreciated?
Well, one of my closest friends was in that locker room and said, yeah, he's a great guy. He connected with his teammates. It wasn't about, oh, I'm Zlatan and, you know, I played here and here and I've won this and I've won this and I'm the greatest. It was, let me help you. And he had these expectations on players. He made the level rise, no doubt. And so, you know, from that standpoint, everyone was really happy that was in that locker room because he pushed you to be better. Now, some guys maybe didn't take it that way as they should have, but he came in with the best of intentions.
From the player with the number 10, Charlie Davies.
Charlie Davies ensam på topp ser till att Hammarby kan gå till ledningen.
Ingen i Hammarby kommunicerade någonsin att Charlie skulle vara någon frälsare eller en poängspelare, utan han var en ung utvecklingsbar spelare som i media målades upp som att han skulle vara färdig. Det tog ett år för honom att leverera det han gjorde i fjol, och det var lite snabbare än vad vi till och med själva hade vågat hoppas på. Men han har fortfarande några steg kvar att ta, och de hoppas vi som sagt att han ska kunna ta i år.
If we go back to when you ended up in Hammarby, you actually were on a kind of a trial with Ajax of the Netherlands and you got injured. And how come it turned out to be Hammarby instead?
I don't know, but I'm really thankful that that's the way it played out. So when I came over to Ajax, Ajax is, you know, probably the best place you can go as a youngster to develop and play first team minutes. However, I think they were going to put me with the reserves at first. I pulled my hamstring in the last trial game, and kind of in that situation of, I don't know what's next. And all of a sudden here, I get a phone call and they say Hammarby has a contract on the table for me. So I fly over to Stockholm. I have a dinner with Tony Gustafsson, and I knew it was the perfect match, because if you have a manager who believes in you, fully believes in you, and is committed to seeing you develop, knowing that, you know, there's probably going to be some ups and downs, which I had, that's probably the best place for me. And it was. And so when I look at Stockholm, the people of Stockholm, the city, the league, there's no better place. There was no better place for me to develop. And it took me a year, but I am so grateful for that opportunity.
What did you know about Hammarby before you signed?
Absolutely nothing. I had never heard of Hammarby, didn't know it existed. So it was one of those things when I came in, I had never, you know, been to Stockholm. I was really curious to see, you know, how the city was kind of made up and how I would be received. And then just to get kind of see where Tony was thinking my kind of ceiling was, and then the league, the team, kind of the style of play, and how he figured, you know, he would use me. So he told me they'd play a two striker system, and that, you know, I had all this talent and potential, and he was going to push me as hard as I could to kind of maximize that.
What was your reaction running into your first game with big crowd?
Excitement. That it was finally a dream that became reality. Actually my first official game was against Copenhagen in Copenhagen, and I just remember being like, this is a big time Champions League club. It was a really good crowd. Actually there was a Swede playing up top for Copenhagen, Marcus Ahlberg, and I believe he scored that game. But I just remember thinking, This is it. This is what I had hoped for. And now I'm finally getting a chance to realize the professional that I can potentially be.
You had quite a few good players at that time in the club. Eguren or Sengen, Petter Andersson, Paulinho, Kingston, the goalkeeper. How was Hammarby at that time?
Incredible culture. You know, I was a young, I would say cocky kid who felt that I didn't have to train 100% every day, and that I could just bring my 100% for the matches and think that was okay. And Tony Gustafsson said, that's not how it works as a professional. You need to bring 100% every single day. And Sebastian Aguirre saw my talent and said, you need to be better every day. And you need to not only you need to try and be your best and better yourself after each training. And so I had a lot of the, I think the veterans in the locker room really pushing me to be better, to be the Charlie Davies that I ended up becoming towards the end of my Hammarby days. And so when I look at the culture of the team, we are always together. We were always hanging out off the pitch as well as on the pitch. It was lighthearted. There were jokes. And we had some great performances. I think I look back and I think to myself, how did we not win SM Gold once or really compete for it And I think we're always just maybe off by one player, maybe. But we had a tremendous locker room, and I think we probably should have deserved more.
What was the key in that you developed into a player that at the end was a regular in the U.S. men's national team?
I'll never forget the one meeting I had with Tony Gustafsson probably halfway through the year in my first season. He sat me in and he said, I see that you have an attitude because you don't start. And I remember he started me, I think, the first four matches of the season, and I didn't score. And I was putting all this pressure on myself. And he said, you're going to come off the bench now from here on out. And so every week I would train well here or there and have that magical training session where I'd score 3, 4, 5 goals. And then on the weekend, I wouldn't be on the starting and wouldn't be in the starting 11. And I put my head down. I'd get so angry. And so 6 months in, he sits me down and says, Charlie, I decide when you're ready. I decide, not you. And so you have two options. You can go home back to the United States, or you can put your head down and train hard every single day with no expectations. You just train hard. And when you start, you will start. But until that day, you just train. You keep your mouth shut and you work hard. And I thought to myself, okay, here it is. Well, obviously I'm not going to go home. I'm going to put my head down and train hard. So every day I would train, and then I would do extra. And I remember Mikael Jensen pulled me aside and said, hey, you got all these tools. It's just that the shot, your final ball or your final chance creation, it needs to be sharper and more efficient. I want you to just take touches and just practice hitting the side of the net so you get used to it. And so I literally trained every day, and I look forward to the extra because it was just finishing. And then I want to say, with 4 games to go that year, Tony finally gave me my start. And I want to say the first one was against Helsingborg at home against Henrik Larsson. And
who was your idol?
Who was my idol? And it was a nil-nil game. I think that's how it finished. And I remember having a conversation with Henrik, and he said, you know, just keep going. You know, you're doing well. It was one of my better games with hold up play, which is one area that Tony wanted me to get better in. And then to finish that year, the hat trick against Geis, it all clicked. And it all clicked with my teammates because they had seen me in training. But that doesn't mean anything if you're not delivering in the matches. And so when I finally hit that hat trick, I think everyone thought, okay, we have something special here. I knew that I was ready to go, but I think now it was the club and the fans and my teammates who thought, okay, next year is going to be his year.
And it was, in a way. What pressure did you feel that, I mean, Hammarby was a stepping stone to going to a bigger club. What pressure did you feel there?
I never felt pressure after that Geis match, because the pressure was I have to score in Allsvenskan.
I have to score in the league. And when I scored a hat trick, the pressure all went away. And I knew, okay, this is how I have to have success for my club, and that'll translate for me. And so that next season, I scored in the first home game, I believe, and then it kind of just kept going. And me and Petter Andersson developed a fantastic partnership. Too bad he had to go and he was sold. I think if we kept Sebastian Aguirre as well, we probably would have had been able to compete for titles. But I just kept growing. And, you know, towards the end of the year, I was looking for, because I saw my friends getting moves to Europe, and I felt, okay, one more season and I'll be good to go. I'm ready for that next step. And so it didn't come, but I was able to play in the Olympics. And, you know, I had a good game against Nigeria. And I just felt like I kept getting better. And so in 2009, my final season with Hammarby, I knew every time we played someone, they're like, we got to mark Charlie. He's the danger guy. I felt I was getting marked by two, sometimes three defenders on the opposing teams, but we didn't have enough on our squad to compete for a trophy. And so I think that's when I knew for sure I had to leave to continue my development. And with the national team, you know, I broke through for that Confederations Cup. And I knew once you taste that level, and you're playing against Puyol, you're playing against Kaká and Xavi, you can't leave it. You can't touch it and then leave it and not want more of it. And so I was kind of that mindset that if I want to be the best Charlie Davies I can be, I need to be playing that level every week. And so that's kind of where I was at that moment. And I think Hammarby as well were keen on getting a transfer fee.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Dagen efter beskedet att Charlie Davies stängs av i 5 matcher är Hammarby-anfallaren starkt kritisk till fotbollsförbundets disciplinnämnd.
Anytime Hammarby does something wrong, they want to really make an example out of Hammarby, and I think they definitely take the fullest out of any suspension they can give Hammarby or any penalty. I don't know who's making the decisions, if there's an Aiko or Ugorin guy making the decisions, but it's pretty tough. It's definitely frustrating for the club.
You were a little bit controversial also. You remember the elbows, Micke Almetbäck. And I even had to have it when we invited you for our TV show, Eka versus Lund. I brought on the helmet. You remember that?
I do. That match, I felt the pressure because the head coach at the time, Bob Bradley, came over to watch that match, and Alejandro Bedoya was on the other side for Orobro. So he was watching two Americans, but I think in particular, he was watching me. And I knew that he was watching me for the Confederations Cup, for World Cup qualifying, to be on that roster. And I wanted to perform, and we were having a really poor game by my standards. And so Almabak was an aggressive defender. He was getting under my skin. He had kicked me a couple of times off the ball, and I said, you know what? This is it. I've had enough. And so the ball was – I thought I was being smart because by this time there was no VAR. And so I threw my elbow back to catch him, caught him in the mouth, I believe, or the nose. I can't remember. And thought, okay, well, this was off the ball. You know, I'll say I was trying to defend, hold up the ball. And so I thought I got away with it in the match. It came back for the 5-game suspension. But
And you were really upset about the 5-game suspension, even though you did it.
Yeah, of course, because I'm a competitor. I want to be on the pitch. And I thought I had outsmarted the system. And I thought the video wasn't, if it was clear cut, close up, and you see me cocking back, fine. I didn't think the video was clear enough, as they like to say in VAR world, clear and obvious. So I felt that they were grabbing onto something, and it's fine because I did do it. So I was guilty. I paid the price, but I never really paid the price because I didn't get to come back and properly serve the suspension.
No, you didn't. And you didn't, at the time, you didn't admit it either, but 12 years later, it's okay.
I admit it. And I apologize to Almabak. I was a young kid who was frustrated, and typically we make those decisions, those kind of actions at times when we're frustrated, and you learn from them. And I never made that mistake again after that. So
Have you a lot of contact with your old teammates from that time in Hammarby?
Yeah. I mean, I would talk with Petter Andersen all the time. We also got to reconnect in Denmark when he was playing there for Midtjylland. And then, Jose Montero, Alaji Sosa. I feel like there's a bunch of Hammarby players that, you know, I'll connect with and talk to every now. We always love to reminisce about the good old days of Stockholm. So I tell you right now, I have so much love and appreciation for the players I played with at Hammarby, but also, and more importantly, the supporters in the club, just because of how they treated me, how they helped me, and you know, the player they were able to help me become.
How close do you follow Hammarby today?
Pretty close, because both Mads Fenger and David Usted I got to play with as well in Denmark for Ronder. So I always keep an eye out on Hammarby. I follow them on social media, so I always get to feel like I'm you know, staying connected and seeing how they're doing. You know, if they have any stars, you know, especially, you know, with Zlatan Ibrahimovic being part owner. So I was always curious to see what he was doing to promote the club.
So when are you coming back to Taylor Tour Stadium?
I cannot wait. You know, I'm my dream is to bring my family and to see my kids have that experience and being like, hey, this is where I started my career. Literally, it's a dream. So as soon as all of this craziness disappears, I'm booking a flight for the family to come out and see Stockholm and see Hammarby.
A soccer player on the U.S. national team is in serious condition after a car accident in the Washington area early Tuesday morning that left one person dead.
När Charlie Davis vaknade upp efter bilolyckan som höll på att kosta honom livet var det en helt ny tillvaro.
My whole right leg was broken and all the other injuries that I had that you know, hopefully I'll be able to walk again.
As you said in the beginning of the interview, you had your ups and downs. And if we go back to 2009, you do a great Confederation Cup in South Africa. You set up a goal for Altidore against Spain and so on. But and you're on the national team when you're doing the qualifiers for the World Cup. And you, the night in October 2009, what happened?
Yeah, it was something where I'm on this rapid rise, and I felt that, you know, coming into to Liga in France and putting in the performances I did, I felt, oh man, I'm ready for the Premier League, and I can be, you know, playing on those Champions League nights. And so, you know, things are happening so fast that you don't even have time to process them. That's kind of the trajectory I was on. I was on this rocket. I left Hammarby and I was on this rocket. And so we played in October, October, I want to say 10th, we were playing in Honduras. And if we won, we qualified for the World Cup, which we did. In that match, I picked up a groin strain. It was really sore, but I didn't pull it, but I knew I wasn't going to be able to play on Wednesday. And we were playing Lyon on the weekend. So I was like, oh, this is my first time playing against Lyon. And everyone knows who Lyon is. It's a big, one of the biggest clubs in Europe or in France. And so on Monday night, I decided to go out with my roommate, Stu Holden, who is in the broadcast space as well. And so I remember thinking to myself, well, why don't we go out? It's a Monday night in DC. Why don't we go listen to some music and hang out? And he was like, Charlie, I'm playing Wednesday. I can't. You're not playing, so you can go ahead. And I'm like, I'm not going by myself. And he said, well, why don't you call one of your friends? And if he can take you, if he'll go with you, then you go with him. And if not, you come back with me. And so I remember thinking of that at that point, is this the right decision? yeah, I guess I'll call my friend. And my friend said, yeah, absolutely, I'll meet you there. So my roommate, Stu Holden, he said, have a good time. Let me know when you're coming back, and I'll see you in the morning.
But you were on curfew. I mean, you weren't supposed to.
Yes, we had curfew at midnight, but this was probably around 10:30 when I left my roommate. So went to meet my friend, and around 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:30, I said, okay, I wasn't drinking. I wasn't partying or anything like that. I said, okay, I'm going to go back. And my friend said, are you sure? And I said, yeah. And so at that point, I ran into two people that I knew, two girls that I knew from last time I came to DC. And they said, we're going too. I can drop you off. And I thought, oh, great. I'm getting a ride home. Perfect. I don't have to hop in a cab. And my friend said, again, are you sure you want to go back? And I said, yeah, I'm okay. So I get in the car and I get behind the passenger. So I'm in the back seat behind the passenger. And we go to a stoplight and she stops kind of hard. And then I remember at that point, I put on my seatbelt and I texted my friend. I almost died. Ha ha. You know, kind of like thing. And my friend said, oh, you'll be back. You'll be fine. Like, let me know when you get home. And that was the last memory I have of that night. And I wake up, I don't know if it was 2 days later, 3 days later, 5 days later. I have just brief snapshots, but I remember the first time I woke up, I thought I was kidnapped in Honduras and that they were stealing my organs because I had 36 staples down my stomach. So I start to take them out because I figured, oh, you know, I'm a genius. I can figure out what they took internally. And I probably got to the fourth staple and I stopped because I was bleeding. And I thought, okay, that's probably not the best idea, but I'm fast. So no one can catch me. So I pop up, I kind of lean up and the nurse sees me and runs over and says, no, no, lie down. And I said, no, you tell me what I'm doing here. And she's like, you're involved in a serious car accident. And I said, anybody can say that. Where am I? And she said, Mr. Davies, you're involved in a very serious car accident and you're in Washington, DC. And we don't know if you're ever going to be able to run again. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm not in Honduras. And I think she might be right. And then I was put with more medication. And I think I was out for another week or so. So I was put on under 2 weeks of medically induced coma. And so then when I finally woke up and I wasn't on so much medication, they had kind of walked me through what had happened, all my injuries. And I think that's kind of when I started to realize my life could be drastically different, but I wasn't yet ready to accept that I wasn't going to be able to play in the World Cup. I thought with my mentality, my mindset, no matter what, I can overcome some of these obstacles. And so I was so curious with when can I start rehabbing? You know, when can I get out of the hospital? So I spent a month in the hospital. And my first day in the rehab hospital, so I spent about 3 weeks in the hospital. I went across the street to the rehab hospital because I still had to relearn how to walk, how to take a shower, how to put on clothes, how to eat food. A lot of these things I forgot from the brain injury that I had. And so when I was relearning how to walk, there were women, older women in their 40s, 50s, 60s who had helmets on, who were like walking around me. And I figured I can't be in this space. This is not good for me. If I'm trying to play in a World Cup and I see people who are out walking me in helmets, older women, this isn't going to work for me. So it took me about 10 minutes to figure out how to move my leg again to walk. And I cried for the first time. My father cried for the first time. I hadn't seen him cry. I don't think my whole life I had never seen him cry. And so that was a powerful moment. So I moved to Delaware, where our national team trainer lived. And so he thought when he first saw me, oh my God, this is like Humpty Dumpty. And I got to put them together again. I couldn't stand up longer than 1 minute without getting dizzy. So that's kind of when the process started for me of trying to get back on the pitch. And miraculously, I mean, or you could say you are absolutely insane to think that I could get back for the World Cup in 6 months, but that was the drive I had. And I would do 12-hour rehab days every day.
You broke two bones in your right leg, elbow, nose, forehead, eye socket. You also suffered a ruptured bladder and bleeding in your brain. I mean, it's really serious.
I mean, a broken femur. So when I was rehabbing, I was asking questions, who else has had my injuries? You know, who can I model my rehab after? And they're like, nobody, no one. The only way you break your femur is in a high impact kind of incident, which typically is a car accident. So I broke my femur and my tibia and my fibula and my right leg. So my right leg looked like an elephant. It was so swollen. And then my left elbow was dislocated and fractured. And from that dislocation and fracture, I could not use my left hand. So all the nerves were asleep. So I had no movement of my left hand. And then, of all those injuries, probably the brain bleed, the brain injury was probably the most significant long-term, because I had to relearn everything. And I went from playing with instincts and knowing how to move and run and cut and to forgetting how to do a lot of those things. You kind of start to pick it up with muscle memory, but some of the things that I used to do so naturally, I couldn't do and still can't do. So that was a struggle, but.
How was the process? I mean, one woman was killed and yes. The other woman was actually sentenced to jail. I think she got 2 years. How was that process, even though you weren't, your guilt was zero, but you were still involved in a car crash where one of the girls you knew died and the other one went to prison.
I would say my guilt was at a million. It was not zero. I felt the most guilt probably of all, because I had this tremendous opportunity. I had my life dream, my life goals in my hands, ready to go, playing in a World Cup. There's nothing better. And not only that, starring in a World Cup that could potentially take your country to a World Cup final. That was kind of the thought process, because we had gone to the Confederations Cup final. We beat Spain and they eventually won the World Cup that year. And so I thought, I think we all thought, we have something special here. And if we can continue to develop and harness that, there's nothing keeping us from getting to a World Cup semifinal. If you get to a World Cup semifinal, anything can happen. And that literally could have played out, because they got to Ghana, they lost to Ghana in a tight one, and Ghana loses a tight one to Uruguay. Probably the best path to get to a World Cup semifinals. But, you know, I felt the most guilt that you could possibly feel, because I put myself in that situation. And so I wake up and I realize my life has been spared, because I'm still alive. Even though my body's mangled, I'm still given a second chance at life. And so you're instantly forced to change the way you think. And I used to think that football, soccer, was everything. That was life. And then I quickly realized that that is not only not the truth, but sports in general is not the truth, that there's so much more to life than that. And so I wanted to live life to, one, make up for this mistake that I made. I felt that I let down not only my family, my parents, my brother, my girlfriend, Nina, who's now my wife, but also my teammates and my country. And the coaches and everyone that believed in me. And really, if you look back, I'm the reason why we didn't go as far as we could have. The team tried to change the way they played, they tried to put someone in to make up for the way I played, and that didn't work out. So I look at it as, man, I had so many sleepless nights because I put that on myself. So the way I was able to move forward was, this happened for a reason, to change the way I think about things, to help people. Because if I can overcome this, there's no limit to how many people I could help who maybe go through something similar to this, being at the top, the peak of their life, to now rock bottom.
How did you overcome this?
I literally took it day by day. I said, for me to get over this, it's got to be physically and emotionally being able to change and to appreciate life and not take anything for granted. So every day I'd wake up with a smile. I still wake up super happy and with a smile on my face, but I knew okay, today the win is if I can do a little bit more, if I can. So once I got through that process of trying to rebuild my body, but I was also rebuilding my mind to think, what can I do to help people? How can I, you know, inspire people? How can I, if I meet someone for the first time, do they have a positive kind of interaction with me? Do they leave with a smile on my face? You know, I realized that if I'm still here, given the car accident, given how I grew up, you know, with a mother who suffers from a severe bipolar disorder, who a father who suffered from a drug addiction, to this crazy car accident, you know, being poor, going through that car accident, and then going through cancer and twin boys that were premature 3 months. If I can do all of this and still wake up every day and have this excitement and have this kind of outlook on life, who the hell can't? Who the hell can't? And so I think that allows people to look at the positive things in life and not necessarily rely on the things that you don't have or the things that you're sour about or complaining about. It's don't complain. How can you complain? And I think I carried that with me every team I played on after. It was like, oh man, this guy's leg is an inch and a half shorter. So he's got to learn how to walk with like a limp to make it look normal now. And he's not complaining. How can I active complain about anything or not be appreciative of anything if he's not complaining? So I think that's how I get through every day, is just being thankful. I'm thankful every day because I know how things can change rather quickly.
What was the reaction from your teammates and from the coach? Since you, I mean, technically you were not guilty. That's what I meant, that you were not driving the car, but you still left the hotel when you should have been in the hotel and so on. Yep. What was the reaction from the teammates and the coaches?
Well, I paid the price, right? So I think if there's always, you know, things where players can break rules or break curfew or break, you know, a promise, right? And nothing happens to them except now people can be mad and angry. I think because I was nearly dead and my life was going to be forever changed, that it was, okay, you paid the price. We forgive you. And that's all you can ask for is forgiveness. And I think they were hopeful that I could, you know, live a normal life at that point. I don't think there's a single person that thought I could play again. Not a single person, including the doctors and probably including my family.
Were you part of the trial against the girl who drove, and what contact did you have with the family who lost a daughter?
No contact with anyone. Not part of any trial. You know, for me, it was, I'm alive, focus on myself and what I can do to make up, you know, what had happened to my teammates, to my family, to my country. And then it was, you have to move on. You have to not think about, you know, the past. You learn from it, grow from it, be a better person. And that's what I've been able to do.
You sued the place where you were at, and also I think some company that was involved for the event. What happened with that suit?
It was settled.
After the car accident, it was doubtful that I might be able to live a normal life again. When my boys were born 3 months prematurely, I didn't know if we would ever get to bring them home. And then, a few months ago, we found out that I had cancer.
I think anytime you hear that word cancer, you just think done for the season, you know, or done for longer. And again, he's kind of proved everyone wrong, you know. He's done that since he's been here.
You came back and started playing, and how was it to take the steps playing? You played in Sochaux, loaned you to the MLS, and then you went back. And how was it to try to perform at the level that you weren't really close?
it was so difficult. When I went back to FC Sochaux, I was really frustrated because they wouldn't clear me medically to go to the World Cup camp. And that's when, you know, you officially have to concede the dream is gone and it'll never come back. And I wasn't willing to concede that dream until it was written and written down. And so I remember I would hide in training. I would try and not get the ball, even though I was there, because I would lose it every time. I didn't have like my balance or coordination properly. It was so tough. Just before that World Cup in 2010, even though I was hoping to go to the World Cup camp, just to say I was at the camp, not even to go to the World Cup, just to be there and send them off and say, look how far I came, surprise, you know, and it wasn't meant to be. And Bob Bradley called me to let me know that he was proud of how far I've come, but that we were going to have this talk eventually, that I wasn't going to be ready and to keep going. And I'll always remember that, because he didn't have to do that. He didn't have to, he could have just said, we're done with Charlie. He broke curfew. Like, we don't need to talk about him because he's not involved. He never did that. He never gave up on me. He always supported me. And so that's something I'll always be grateful and thankful for. But then I started to get better in trainings post the World Cup and into that, that next season around Christmas time was the last match before Christmas break in France. The coach put me on the bench for the first time. I made the squad against Bordeaux. And I was like, oh my God, I'm finally getting there. I didn't play, but I was on the bench and that felt good. And then, you know, just after the break, he said, Charlie, I think you're getting closer, but you need to go somewhere where you're going to get consistent minutes. And so I got loaned back to the United States to play in Major League Soccer for DC United. So that was the crazy thing for me, is the same city that this accident occurred in. Now I'm going back to play there. So that first match, I had all the doctors and nurses come out who helped me the night of the accident to watch me play and say, hey, you know, I might be playing professional soccer again officially. And that night I scored 2 goals, and you can imagine the emotion that took place. But yeah, I went back to DC, and you know, you still got to deal with injury. I'd pick up a hamstring injury here or groin injury here because of my leg difference, the leg length difference, just your body trying to compensate for so many changes. And you know, I felt like I started to push through a little bit. I went back to France, and that was such a major accomplishment for myself to say I played in two Ligue 1 matches, official matches, against Rennes and against Toulouse. So full circle, I was never the same player, because I lost, you know, two or three steps of speed. So I was still kind of fast, but not the quickness I had in the past. But I was so proud of myself to know that I got back to be able to play in Ligue 1 again. Go to Denmark, never settled there with the Club Randers. I'm not sure what it was. I always look back, I'm like, I had great training sessions, a good team, good locker room. But for whatever reason, I never was given a proper opportunity. I never took the opportunities I was given in the matches that I came in to. And so I came home to the Revolution, and that's really kind of where I got back to being the best player I could be, given I'm Charlie Davies 2.0 now. And so I settled in rather nicely. I understood where I could have success, how I could help my team. And things were looking really good.
Yeah, you had a great season there in 2015. There was even talk about the national team. You scored 10 goals. And how come you couldn't build on that?
I think I was just missing, you know, the X factor. And so the X factor for me was always my speed and quickness. And it was elite. It was world class. And then if you don't have that, you could still be good. And I was smart. I was so much more in tune with the match and, you know, movements. But if you want to be a game changer, and especially on the international level, you have to have a little bit something different. And that was that for me. And I didn't have that anymore. So did I deserve to be on the national team? Probably not. And so I was always pushing to catch my old self. And it was never going to be, till as long as I played professional soccer, I was going to try and play to get myself on the national team. I could have been 35, 36, 37. If I'm still playing, that's that's what's pushing you. That's what's going to keep you motivated. I think it's similar to a Zlatan Ibrahimovic, what keeps him going, because he could have retired, you know, 5-10 years ago if he wanted to. He has won so many trophies, but it's that success and pushing yourself to be better, no matter how old you are. I mean, it's rare. It's rare to have. And I think I had that kind of determination.
You even went on to Philadelphia Union, but in the meantime, you even had cancer, as you talked about before. I mean, a very rare cancer. How were you able to overcome that obstacle?
That was the lowest point in my life. I thought, you know, after the car accident and near-death experience and not getting to be fulfilled at the potential that you had as a soccer player, I thought that would, there's nothing that would come close to that as long as you're alive. And I was wrong. When they told me I had cancer and my twin boys were still in the hospital, in the intensive care unit, I thought, this is it. Life finally caught up with me. And now I'm not going to get to see my kids grow. I'm not going to get to be a father or a husband. And that was kind of it. Cause when you hear cancer, you usually think of chemotherapy, radiation, you think of death and, you know, not knowing anything else about what you have. So, thankfully I'm in Boston, and for sarcoma treatments, it's, arguably the best in the world. So Dr. Andrew Wagner, sat me down, told me kind of what I was dealing with, and that it was caught very early. So I always look at, man, the reason it was caught early was because the boys were born so early, which caused me to get fatigued, which caused me to then pull a muscle for them to find this tumor. So it's weird the way things have worked. And I think everything happens for a reason again. And from the strength and the experience I've had from overcoming, you know, a near-death experience, I was almost ready for this challenge. No matter what comes in front of me, I'm going to handle it. I have to be strong for my family. I have to continue that positive kind of outlook. And so I know I'm not done. I don't know what's in store for me next, but I think what I have learned that is, if you do have the right people around you, the support system, and you do keep, you know, looking at things in a positive frame of mind, positive light, that you will overcome it, and that they don't last. The tough times don't last.
Great. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Thank you. It's been a throwback. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Great.
Podden är producerad av Anton Toft och klippt av Daniel Eriksson. Vi tar tacksamt emot alla synpunkter, idéer, önskemål eller vad det nu må gälla. Enklast är att mejla mig olof.lund@tv4.se eller skriva till mig på Instagram eller Twitter, och då är det Olof Lund som gäller i ett ord. Stort tack för den här veckan!
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.